This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you. Good evening and welcome to Navarra Live. I'm your host, Ash Sarkar. Some breaking news first. OJ Simpson has died at the age of 76 years old. The real tragedy is that he got to live far longer than he deserved. And now that I am no longer encumbered by libel laws, I can say this. He fucking did that shit. Helena, aka No Justice MTG, you are with us tonight. How are you doing?
Absolutely. I'm not doing too bad at all. Always a pleasure to co-host the show with you today, Ash.
Well, I'm very excited to have you with me for this next hour. Coming up later tonight, Sunak's pledges are again in the spotlight after new data on NHS waiting lists came out today. There's new hope for Julian Assange in his fight against extradition to the US. And we'll look at the media outrage over the protests outside Keir Starmer's house. So stay tuned for all that. Let's go to our first story. The world appears to be bracing itself for an attack on Israel by Iran, as signs appear to indicate Tehran may soon act. The escalation in tensions between the two countries follows Israel's bombing of the Iranian consulate in Syria earlier this month. 11 people were killed, including 7 Iranian Revolutionary Guards, one of whom was a senior commander. On Tuesday, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned that Israel, quote, must be punished and it will be. And last night, Iranian media posted on Twitter reports that the country's defense minister had ordered all airspace over Tehran be shut down for, quote, military drills. This morning, the Mehr news agency removed that tweet, denying it had ever issued that news. Israel has also been operating Air Force maneuvers. On Wednesday, the Israeli Air Force conducted long-range air drills in conjunction with the Air Force of Cyprus. According to Israel's public broadcaster, it also said that the drills were in preparation for a potential Iranian attack. Meanwhile, British and other foreign diplomats in Israel have been advised to stock up on essential items in case of an attack. They've also been advised to carry radios when away from home in case mobile networks are disrupted. So tensions are definitely mounting. US President Joe Biden issued a warning to Iran, saying this.
We also want to address the Iranian threat to launch a significant, they're threatening to launch a significant attack on Israel. As I told Prime Minister Netanyahu, our commitment to Israel's security against these threats from Iran and its proxies is ironclad. Let me say it again, ironclad. We're going to do all we can to protect Israel's security.
In a briefing to Al Jazeera, US officials have gone even further. The Guardian reports that they told the broadcaster that, quote, not only was it willing to help Israel defend itself from any Iranian missile or drone strike, but it may also be prepared to join an Israeli counter-offensive. That is a remarkable statement, raising the prospect of the US joining forces with Israel to launch attacks against Iran. Of course, at this stage, the US may simply be trying to moderate Iran's potential response to Israel, rather than genuinely committing to any offensive. The UK is getting in on the rhetoric too, with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak saying this. The threats from Iran are completely unacceptable, and we, like the Americans, fully support Israel's right to defend itself against that. We have already highlighted Iran as a significant risk to regional security, and we have always said that we will support Israel's ability to defend itself, and we are taking action ourselves to make sure we can protect the UK against threats from Iran. Hearing those words, you'd almost forget that Israel attacked first. And it's worth pointing out that neither the US nor the UK has condemned Israel's attack on the consulate in Damascus, with the UK, France, and the US vetoing a statement of condemnation from the UN Security Council last week. Meanwhile, Benjamin Netanyahu visited an Israeli airbase where he said this, "We are in challenging times. We are in the midst of a war in Gaza that is continuing with full force. In addition, we are continuing with ceaseless efforts to return our hostages, but we are also preparing for challenges from other fronts. We set a simple principle. Anyone who hits us, we hit them. We are ready to fulfill our responsibilities to Israel's security in defense and attack. As the war of words gets louder, others are taking more concrete precautionary measures. Russia and Germany have both urged Iran and Israel to show restraint. Germany's foreign minister has called for, quote, maximum restraint, and a Kremlin spokesperson said this. Right now, it's very important for everyone to maintain restraint so as not to lead to a complete destabilization of the situation in the region, which doesn't exactly shine with stability and predictability. Moscow has also advised its citizens against all travel to the Middle East. At the same time, Lufthansa, one of Europe's only two airlines offering flights to Iran, has suspended all flights to Tehran. But despite those calls for restraint, some in Israel want to raise the stakes. Former Israeli ambassador to the US, Danny Ayalon, told Sky News this.
By striking at the head of the snake, as we call it, in Iran and in Tehran, this is probably the most effective way to bring Iran back to its, keep it at bay.
I mean, that's a gamble, isn't it, Daniel? I know you're not making the decision, but striking at the head of the snake, there's every chance the snake's head, I mean, it's like, what do they call it? An animal that has heads that keep coming back, you know, it may not, in fact, cause the head to be struck off, as it were.
Yeah, but, you know, if we take the precedence of taking Qasem Soleimani by the Americans in 2020, the Iranians have not really found yet a replacement which is up to par with him. So to frustrate the command and control system and the structure of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, that could really put them back.
Go to war with a country that's developing its nuclear capabilities and has a highly developed military-industrial complex. Great idea. I do think, however, this is a pretty fair characterization of the Israeli position. Dragging the US into a wider regional conflict might be bad for the world, but ultimately, it's very good for Israel. Next story. Rishi Sunak owes the country an election, but he's been putting it off while he hopes for an improvement in the country's fortunes. The measure he set the electorate for how his government is doing is captured by his five pledges: stop the boats, halve inflation, grow the economy, lower debt, and bring down NHS waiting lists. But on that last front, he's not doing well. New NHS England figures show over 7.5 million people were waiting for treatment on the health service in February. That figure is a drop of just 40,000 from January's figures. It's the fifth month in a row that's seen a reduction in the number of people waiting. But there are only around 200,000 fewer people on the list than when it hit an all-time high of almost 7.8 million in September last year. Now, there's one thing that's worth pointing out. Ministers have regularly blamed doctors, nurses, and other NHS worker strikes for the size of the waiting list. But the NHS itself has revealed that, had the strikes not happened, there would only be around 400,000 fewer people waiting for NHS care, meaning that the waiting list would still have stood at over 7 million given today's figures. Still, some government ministers are lauding the slow-motion reduction as a success. This was Health Secretary Victoria Atkins on the BBC.
The number of people waiting compared to this time last year is up 360,000, and compared to when the Prime Minister came into office, is up 620,000. So it's all very well saying that these lists, these waiting times are coming down, but they're still too high. And you say there are some parts of the country that are doing well. Where?
Well, we every single week I'm looking at the trusts. There are some 160 trusts that we are looking at to ensure that we know that for example, A&E waiting times. There are trusts that are meeting and exceeding the 80% target for people being treated within 4 hours.
Could you name them?
So what I want to do, if I may, I don't think it's fair, actually, for trusts to be, you know, I've tried always it to be even-handed with how I deal with trusts. So I will, we look at the trusts and try and support
If you are going to flag ones that are doing well, great. You say that there are ones doing well. Say them out loud. Well, we've had comments from all over the country.
Yeah.
I'm sure, and our audience, and I will keep telling you what our audience is saying. But you tell me where these areas are. Tell our audience where these great trusts are.
Again, I think all I'm trying to do is to put into context that in an enormous system that treats 1.3 million people a day, that saw in the month of February 74,000 people going into A&E every single day, what I'm saying is that we know that there will be some people who have the sorts of experiences that are simply unacceptable, as you've already described, but there are also people who have had good experiences.
It's not so bad, guys, because not absolutely every human being on the planet is having a hard time with the NHS. In that clip, Atkins was trying to divert attention away from waiting lists and to impose a different measure of how the NHS is performing, namely A&E waiting times. That probably wasn't her best ever idea. 2022 was the worst year on record for A&E waiting times, with 165,000 patients waiting 4 hours or more before being seen in December of that year. By March 2022, there were around 140,000 waiting 4 hours or more to be seen. But the figures for March this year are worse, with several thousand more waiting for extended periods than in 2022. Of course, it's too soon to tell how that will pan out across the year. But we do know that the NHS isn't hitting its target. 76% of A&E patients should be seen in under 4 hours, but only 74% are. And when we look at the numbers of people waiting 12 hours or more, the figures are simply shocking. Again, 2022 was the worst year on record, with figures hitting nearly 60,000 in December that year. But in March 2022, the numbers waiting half a day or more to be seen were far below where they are today. Nearly 45,000 people waited more than 12 hours to be seen this March, making it the worst March on record for A&E waiting times. The overall picture is one of a health service in crisis, and it's obvious why. The King's Fund has shown just how dramatically spending on the health service changed under austerity. Under the last Labour government, NHS spending was increased by 5.5% in real terms each year. That fell to around just 1% per year under the coalition government, and then rose to just over 3% per year under the Tories. If there isn't a sufficient real-term increase in spending each year, then the NHS just isn't equipped to deal with growing challenges without dipping into budgets that should be spent on patients. Examples of those challenges include an ageing population, a population that's increasing in size, more advanced expensive medicines and treatments, and an estate of older buildings requiring increasing upkeep. Yet, despite those challenges, Sunak's government isn't increasing spending on the NHS. On Radio 4's Today programme, Victoria Atkins was asked about where the money is going instead.
Why is your party, the Conservative Party, promising billions of pounds in unfunded tax cuts at a time that there's a crisis in the NHS and a Conservative Prime Minister hasn't even met the pledge that he made on coming to office?
Well, at the spring budget, the Chancellor was not only able to offer the second tax cut to working people in a row from autumn statement, adding up to some £900 or so for the average worker, but he was also able to ensure that a further £2.5 billion has gone into day-to-day spending for the NHS.
What does that mean per patient? Secretary of State?
Well, what that
because we've got an increasing population.
We do, but we simply don't measure NHS budgets in that way because
people do measure it. I'll give you the figures if I may, which is between 2022 and 2024, health spending under Treasury plans published in that budget will fall, not increase, on average by 1.6 per year per person. In real terms.
So
this isn't a real increase to the health budget at all.
It very much is. We are spending record amounts on the NHS.
We're always spending record amounts because of inflation and an increasing population. It's a meaningless statistic.
We always spend more
1 year than the year before.
Well, no, Nick, that's not correct. You know, I'm afraid, you know, there's nothing inevitable about this. As I say, the Chancellor invested £2.5 billion more into the NHS. We already have, you know, this is £165 billion that we're spending on the NHS. But I'll just take you back to your point about patients.
Why are you cutting taxes when the health service needs more money?
So,
why are you not even spending on the scale that Margaret Thatcher did?
Forgive me.
She increased spending by more than 4% a year in real terms. You are planning, even if you don't allow for a population increase, an increase of less than 1%.
It goes without saying that Nick Robinson did not receive an answer to that question. That's because if we want Tory answers to NHS problems, Labour has already taken them all. The party has made zero spending commitments on the NHS, but it's promised to divert money to the private sector anyway. This was Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting on GB News.
Will you have the political will to take on unions who might try and frustrate your attempts to use more private care to try and clear these waiting lists?
I think people can see that I'm prepared to put people's noses out of joint to do the right thing when it comes to patients, getting people seen faster. I've been accused, Chris, as you know, people have seen in recent days and weeks and months, actually, of wanting to privatise the NHS, that over my dead body would we privatise the NHS. I think one of the best things about it is that it's a public service and that when you fall ill, you don't have to worry about the bill. But we've got in the private sector spare capacity. Those who can afford it are paying to go private. They are being seen faster. Working class people who can't afford it are being left behind. And so what I'd say to my critics is, you look those people in the eye and you tell them that you're prepared to see them wait longer because of your left-wing principles. I don't think that's right. I'm prepared to take on those arguments and do the right thing by patients because I came into politics to help people from working-class backgrounds like mine to make sure everyone in this country gets a fair crack. And that's what a Labour government will do.
If you could clear that list with using the private sector for all of it, would you?
If you could, I would. I mean, I think it's got to be a balance. And that's why, as well as using spare private sector capacity, I've said, look, over time, we've got to make sure we've got, you know, the capacity in the NHS that the NHS needs.
Now, Streeting's argument for using the private sector to relieve waiting lists sounds good on paper. But there are several fatal flaws. Private hospitals don't have A&Es, so they're not going to touch those waiting times. They do have operating theatres. But if something goes wrong, patients just get shipped back to the NHS for emergency care anyway. That's around 6,000 of them every year. And the surgeons and consultants working in the private sector are, on the whole, moonlighting from their day jobs in the NHS. So it's not like private medicine has its own additional army of doctors willing to crack on with NHS waiting lists for the right price. Plus, private hospitals are already doing around 10% of all elective surgeries that would otherwise have been performed on the NHS. In 2023, private hospitals performed 1.7 million procedures on NHS patients. And yet, the waiting list just kept on growing. Helena, you heard from Wes Streeting there. He's not afraid to put noses out of joint. He's going to piss off ideological lefties because he wants the best care for working class people. Why isn't he getting pushed on this question of how much private sector capacity is there and will using it in the end work out more expensive than just getting those doctors to perform that care in the NHS?
I guess mostly he's not being asked it because mainstream media journalists in this country are absolutely clueless idiots who haven't got a clue what they're talking about. But aside from that, the main questions that we need to be talking about with regards to the NHS is how do we actually bring down the waiting list? And of course, I mean, West Streeting hasn't necessarily misdiagnosed the problem, which is a lack of staffing and a lack of overall physical capacity. When it comes to staffing, Labour do have a proper solution to this, which is a workforce plan. But then again, the Tories also have their own workforce plan, where about thousands of nurses and doctors short of the staffing that we need to ensure that we can bring waiting lists down with regards to what's happening in the NHS at the moment. But again, we have to ask, what are their plans to be able to actually fix these issues? For example, when it comes to staffing, all of these workforce plans, they talk about recruitment and retention, but they are talking in terms of what we've heard in rhetoric from the Labour Party. Oh, well, it's not just about pay. It's not just about pay. It's all about making sure that you feel like that you're being respected and valued in your job. And whilst that's probably not necessarily untrue, they also won't commit to proper increases in pay for people to ensure that they can not only recruit them, but retain them in their jobs. Because the biggest kind of brain drain that we have on NHS talent is that they're all going off to Australia where they can get good salaries. And yet the current Conservative government won't kind of acquiesce to the demands of the unions in terms of pay restoration. Not pay rises, remember, this is pay restoration in real terms to where they were in 2010. And Labour have said they don't want to do this either. So the kind of the biggest factor in maintaining and also increasing staffing capacity in the NHS is going to be making sure that we don't hemorrhage these people to places where they're going to get much more lucrative careers. There's obviously a global market that we're talking about here. Interesting that all of these people who believe in market economics don't seem to understand how it works. And on top of that as well, when it comes to where else we're going to find more people in kind of physical terms, both Labour and the Conservatives, and Labour are more forthright on this from what Keir Starmer has been saying, is they don't want an influx of new people from outside the UK coming here to work in the NHS. They want to train up our existing people at a time at which unemployment figures are close to record lows. Like, there's not spare people that you can just train up to work in the NHS. When it comes to capacity, what we actually need is a lot of capital investment. Again, this is something that Labour are being very quiet on, and the Tories haven't done it at all. I mean, they promised 40 new hospitals. We haven't got them. Ironically, this Boris Johnson policy is probably the best NHS policy that we've heard in terms of fixing this problem in the last 15 years outside of what Labour brought to the table in 2017 and 2019. And it just hasn't come to fruition. And this is why we're in the predicament that we're in. So, given these the problems, will the private sector solve them? Now, you've already covered the fact that there's no like army of doctors, no kind of surplus army of doctors coming here to be able to fulfill that recruitment target. So that's not going to work either. They're all just NHS staff working kind of locum in the private sector. These are people who they can't even convince to do overtime in the NHS because they know they can get better work through agency fees through the private sector. And in terms of physical capacity, there are actually very few private hospitals in this country. You'd have thought, right? You'd have thought that if this was a possible solution to this crisis, that is essentially one of the biggest things costing the Conservative Party the next election, the Tories, who are in bed with the private sector, you'd think they would have done it already, wouldn't you? They think they would have utilized this huge sprawling private sector capacity that West Streeting alludes to, and they haven't done it because it doesn't exist. It's just a complete fabrication there. And when you look at what's interesting as well is that if you want to compare Labour's plans, they're basically the same as Reform UK. Like, Reform UK have said, well, we're going to have 17 billion extra in the NHS, more than Labour are promising. And we're also going to give people vouchers to go private to bring the waiting lists down. How different is that to what Labour are proposing here? That's coming from Richard Tice and Nigel Farage. Really and truly, spending is the issue. People talk about record spending, and of course that will happen over time regardless, as Nick Robinson pointed out. But we own it, have done lots of studies showing that still per capita, we're lower than a lot of our European partners on this. In terms of capital investment, we've been really far down, and private procurement is costing us a lot of money. So for example, you look at how much we spend on generics pharmaceuticals. They've massively gone up because they've been cartelized by our imports, where we could be making these at home if we had like a state manufacturing plant for these. The one thing that has to happen to fix this issue is that the fiscal rule in terms of only borrowing to invest, that has to go. Right? Both Jeremy Hunt and Rachel Reeve subscribe to this. It has to go because one of the forces that allow you to be able to spend money using borrowing is whether you're going to project more growth because of it. And one of the things that's massively impacting our economic growth right now is the huge number of people who cannot work because they're too sick, because they're stuck on waiting lists. So if we have to increase the fiscal deficit, if we have to increase the debt to GDP ratio to be able to get us in the position where we can then grow out of it later, we absolutely should do that. So all of this kind of talk around, well, we can't do all this capital investment necessarily, or well, we can't just spend all of this money, is complete nonsense, given how much of a gigantic issue in terms of our national economy the NHS is. And trying to rely on the private sector to do that, trying to rely on just efficiency savings that don't exist, that's not going to cut it either. So we really do need some broad-based and pretty radical policy to solve this.
Does investing in a healthier workforce improve the economy? More on this investigation as we get it. Let's move on to our next story. Today marks the fifth anniversary of Julian Assange's incarceration at Belmarsh, a maximum security prison in Thamesmead, London. But his campaign not to be extradited to the United States to face espionage charges has been given a small boost of encouragement. Australia, where the WikiLeaks founder is originally from, lodged a request with the American government to drop its prosecution of Assange. When asked about the request by reporters at the White House on Wednesday, Joe Biden said, quote, "We're considering it." If extradited to the US, Assange could face many years in prison or even the death penalty. In 2021, a British district judge said Mr. Assange should not be sent to the US, citing, quote, "a real and oppressive risk of suicide." This was later overturned after the US appealed to the High Court. This is from Sky News. During a two-day court hearing earlier this year, lawyers for Mr. Assange asked for permission to bring an appeal against his extradition to the US. Judges Dame Victoria Sharp and Mr. Justice Johnson dismissed most of his arguments, but ruled he could not immediately be extradited unless the US gave further assurances about what will happen to him. Unless the US drop their charges in the meantime, there'll be another hearing in Assange's case in May. Now, before we get too excited, I think it's important to watch the very brief clip where President Biden says he's considering dropping Julian Assange's charges.
Do you have a response to Australia's request that you end Julian Assange's prosecution?
We're considering.
I know that heads of state choose their words very carefully, and it might be the case that Biden is signalling a change in his government's position. But he does say we're considering it very offhandedly. It may be that this is just the presidential equivalent of saying your email has been received. Basically, it's being polite to Australia rather than an indication of policy direction. Helena, what do you think? Could Biden be on the verge of changing his mind about Julian Assange?
You know what? I'm going to be cautiously optimistic about this. I mean, we already have precedent for specifically members of the Democratic Party and being lenient with these things previously. Of course, it was Barack Obama who very famously granted clemency to Chelsea Manning, someone intimately connected to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. So I do think that they're given the precedent that we have. And what we have seen as well very recently is Joe Biden's willingness to at least move somewhat in response to Democratic pressure internally and globally as well. You've seen a very slow shift in terms of his response to policy with regards to Israel. And so I can hope, I think that there is room further to go, especially given that we have seen kind of renewed pressure from Australia. I've actually been really mostly impressed with Anthony Albanese's position on this, given that I don't have many good words to say about him usually, in terms of trying to pressure the Americans to try and have some movement on this position, with diplomatic talks wanting to be assured between these two countries, which have been very, very historic. They just obviously signed AUKUS. The AUKUS pact is very strong between the two countries. They still want to operate. The CIA still operates out of Pine Gap in Australia. So maintaining these diplomatic ties over something this serious, I think, is a leverage that Albanese could use to try and twist Biden's arm on this. It's worth pointing out, though, even if this does happen, even if this does happen, and we do get some miracle that Biden does consider and then acquiesces to it, why has it taken this long? Why does it have to take international pressure, international condemnation, internal pressure, an outcry for, you know, the protection of journalists around the globe in terms of being able to know what our politicians do and what our government does behind our own back? Why should it take all of this time for the Democrats to even consider this position? And it really just shows you kind of whose side that they really on, and that they will only bow to overwhelming public pressure, even if they do. And what does it say about the future of investigative journalists if, after all of this, after everything, they can't even have like a firm position? And that if you want to do proper investigative journalism over the crimes that your state engages in behind your back, your only real defense that you can have is, well, maybe at some point a president might be nice enough to be able to drop the charges in lieu of anything else happening, rather than us being properly protected when we do our investigative journalism. So it's worth caveating that even if this does happen, this isn't the end of where we need to have our discussion over the free press.
Just to go back to Biden for a second, what are the kinds of political pressures that are on him going in either direction for how to deal with Julian Assange? Because you mentioned Barack Obama pardoning Chelsea Manning. That's something which happened in his second term. Of course, Biden's still in his first. He's looking down the barrel of an election this year. So in what way can political pressure, you know, sway him on this particular issue?
The kind of supporters that Julian Assange has in the United States are usually people who are not that much inside the political spectrum that seems set in their ways in terms of voting in general elections. It's interesting that actually, even this, not that far out from Barack Obama's presidency, the broad state of American politics has shifted very, very wildly. The neocons of the past are no longer represented, especially in the right of American politics. And I think a lot of people on the right who have more libertarian leanings are actually more pro-Assange than, you know, a lot of people who were kind of traditionally part of the Republican supporter base. They tend to be not very pleased with what they consider to be the deep state, like the third entity with regards to American politics. And so anything that does undermine that, I think they broadly have support of. And so Joe Biden, who is massively struggling in the opinion polls at the moment, the fact that the Democrats are running literally anybody who could lose to Trump shows that they need to be able to curry favor with some people who might vote for Trump for being critical of the American establishment. And who is like somebody who is an explicit enemy of the establishment, somebody who exposes their war crimes. And given the anti-neocon push in the American right at the moment, or in the American center, or like the libertarian side of American politics, seems to kind of so visceral in their disgust in terms of the pro-war policies of the kind of neoconservative past, I think that there could be some belief in Democratic Party politics that by trying to appeal to these kind of voters, they might be able to pull over people who would otherwise be voting for Trump.
I think that's a really interesting point that you made about the neocons being a lot more marginalized on the American right. One thing that I'd say is that the sort of Trump supporter base, I think, is very flexible. So on the one hand, you can say Julian Assange is a victim of the deep state. And I think that's something that would resonate an awful lot with their worldview. Another way of pitching this to them, and I imagine this is what some figures on the Republican right would say, is, oh, well, he endangered our troops abroad. And I think that they're open to both narratives, but we'll, of course, cover this story as it develops further. Let's move on. This week, activist group Youth Demand have been taking part in what they term civil resistance over Israel's assault on Gaza and the climate crisis. Their goal is to pressure the Tories and Labour to commit to a two-way arms embargo with Israel and for there to be an end to new oil and gas licences. Together with Palestine Action, they sprayed red paint over the Ministry of Defence building in central London. Five activists were arrested. But it's a protest outside Labour leader Keir Starmer's house that's really got everybody talking.
I'm Ella, I'm 21, and I'm here today. I've just put up this banner outside of Keir Starmer's house saying, Starmer, stop the killing. Starmer's the leader of the Labour Party. He's got enormous power, enormous influence, and he can call on a two-way arms embargo on Israel to stop sending UK-made weapons over that are being used to cause genocide. He can also stop the Tory oil and gas licences. He can revoke them. He knows that that will also cause mass death. He knows these things. And, you know, I see his humanity, you know. He's an individual, but he's got an enormous amount of power to do the right thing. And he's at a position where he's got an enormous opportunity to make a real difference and to do something and to stop mass death that we know is coming from the climate crisis. He can stop sending UK-made bombs over that are being used on innocent children. It's just through circumstance that Mr. Starmer's not in Palestine. It's through circumstance that I'm not in Palestine. You know, I think we have to see everyone's humanity in this situation. And it's on every single person now to do the right thing. And that includes Mr. Starmer.
Three young activists tied a banner that read "Starmer, stop the killing" outside the Labour leader's house. They also placed pairs of children's shoes outside his door to symbolise the loss of innocent life in Gaza. The three individuals were arrested and charged with public order offences. This is from the BBC's write-up of the case. Prosecutor David Burns told Westminster Magistrates Court the incident had really affected Sir Keir's wife. He said she had returned from shopping with her son, but could not go home because she felt intimidated. Protesting outside politicians' residences has become an increasingly controversial tactic. This is what Rishi Sunak had to say about the youth demand sit-in outside Keir Starmer's house. "I don't care what your politics are, no MP should be harassed at their own home. We cannot and will not tolerate this." Echoing the Prime Minister, this is from Mail on Sunday journalist Dan Hodges. "Why is this still being tolerated? Why is the targeting of politicians' homes not a criminal offence, especially in the current climate?" And City AM's Jack Mendel tweeted this. "One, going to a politician's family home and publicising where they live is so low there are not words to describe it. Two, Starmer is not the Prime Minister, you absolute fuckwits. He cannot stop the killing. He is the leader of the opposition. He has no actual power." He followed up by writing, "God, they're such entitled brats. Literally, why aren't you doing something more important with your life, like working or studying? Something productive that helps society, instead of harassing elected politicians at their private houses." I don't know, Jack, maybe pressuring politicians to help stop a genocide is worth something to society. Now, more than a few people have pointed out that there's a big old double standard at play here. When Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party, he was regularly doorstepped. His personal residence was considered fair game for journalists who wanted to press him for comment. And members of his family who don't have careers in politics were put under the spotlight. Who could forget this classic headline from the Daily Mail? "Jeremy Corbyn is accused of staging a bizarre stunt to dodge questions about Labour's anti-Semitism crisis as he walks out of his house with two women wildly shouting in Spanish," Spanish is in all caps, just in case you're listening on the podcast, "and gesticulating at reporters." Women speaking Spanish, the language that they speak. Oh my God, can you believe it? But this just goes to show, right? Not only was his home considered fair game, so, you know, were his family members and the language that they speak. When asked by Owen Jones on Twitter whether he thinks that journalists should also be criminalised for camping outside of politicians' homes, Dan Hodges said this: "No, because they're professional journalists conducting legitimate scrutiny of a senior politician, not activists seeking to intimidate a politician. As you would know if you were a journalist rather than an activist." This is where I think it all gets a bit ridiculous, because it's totally fair enough to say that politicians' homes, particularly ones that they share with other people, should be off limits. So that means no protests and no press intrusion either. What's absurd is to say that three activists sitting peacefully with children's shoes is intimidating, but a gaggle of reporters getting in your face with a camera shouting at you about anti-Semitism is not. When journos didn't get an answer from Corbyn on a question that they had, they plastered his mother-in-law's face all over the papers. Now, that is harassing and intimidating behaviour. This is a point echoed by Diane Abbott on Twitter. "As someone who has faced extreme harassment from members of our media outside my home, I do not agree with targeting anyone or their families where they live." You can't have different rules for different politicians. But it's not just the manner of protest that some journalists have a problem with. Indeed, if you're LBC host Ben Kentish, you might struggle to see the point in asking politicians to change their positions on anything at all.
I wonder if you've ever considered joining those protests, would you? If someone texted you saying, we're going down Keir Starmer's, bring a banner, bring some children's shoes, would you ever be tempted to say, all right, do you know what? Yes, I'll do that. That's a good, healthy, productive way of me expressing my opinion and trying to pressure a politician into doing what I want. I mean, Keir Starmer, stop the killing was the banner. What do they want him to do? He's the leader of the opposition, for Christ's sake. Keir, what is he meant to do? Go waltzing into Gaza by himself, waving white flag. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? It's ridiculous. That's not the key point here. The key point is they want him to pledge to stop arms sales to Israel. Fine. But Keir Starmer, stop the killing. I think they're possibly targeting the wrong man and certainly targeting him in the wrong way.
It's ridiculous. It's preposterous. It's so silly. He's the leader of the opposition. He can't do anything. Well, like, what's the fucking point of him having a job then? It's not difficult to imagine, for instance, the Journo response if Labour said they weren't going to back weapons for Ukraine simply because they're not in government and it's all pointless otherwise. They'd be pitching a fit. What we see here is one of my favourite media tropes. Journalists pretending not to understand politics simply because they don't like a particular cause. Helena, where do you stand on this issue of protesting outside politicians' homes? In favour, against, somewhere in the middle?
I am absolutely against it. I do not think we should be protesting specifically outside people's houses. Constituency offices, though, 100% fair game. And I would say I absolutely encourage people to go and protest many times outside people's constituency offices, because they are the people who need to be held to account for their positions on policy issues, whether in government or in opposition, that they are constantly failing on. And obviously, their continued failure to actively oppose what's happening with the genocide in Gaza is something that is very much well worth it. But houses, I do not think, is places where people should go. And I fundamentally agree with Diane Abbott's position on this. Whereas, you know, where the line is drawn between legitimate protest and harassment is different for different people. And I think we need to be really cautious of that. Of course, you know, like Keir Starmer's kids didn't get asked if they wanted to be born to a family of somebody who would go on to endorse war crimes. So I want to be really clear that I do not think the houses are a place that you should go and protest, even though in this case, right, in this very specific case, I don't think that necessarily too many lines got broken. Well, a banner and some shoes, like this isn't you know, personally what I would categorize as being intimidating. But once you breach that barrier of saying, okay, well, we can protest outside any MP's homes, well, just because we believe our cause personally is just, like, what stops there from being, you know, like an anti-immigration protest from like the EDL or something outside an individual MP's home? Like, we would all, on our side, we understand just how kind of intimidating and harassing that would be. By all means, they can do that outside constituency offices, at their place of work, where they do indeed represent what they should be or shouldn't be doing. That's where I would personally draw the line, because I think we set a dangerous precedent, even in these cases, such as the very kind of very small protest that we've seen here, where, you know, a level of principle and precedent has to be set to ensure that we maintain kind of some level to which that the discourse stays reasonable. What I would say, though, all of these journalist comments, honestly, it really does beggar belief. They say, oh, we as journalists, we have to go and completely doorstep Jeremy Corbyn and literally nobody else because he's a politician. I'm like, could you not go to his constituency office? Could you not go to any time when he was leader of the Labour Party, to any one of his many speaking events, to go and try and speak to him there? No, they have to go outside his house again. It's one rule for them and another rule for everybody else. It's a very, very silly position. And one last comment I would make around Ben Kentish specifically saying, oh, he's just the leader of opposition. What could he do? And I'm just like, people want to see an opposition. The one thing that this very much reminded me of was that moment during the pandemic where it was this very kind of enraged, I think it was a pub landlord, speaking to Keir Starmer. It was absolutely seething, saying, where is your opposition? Where's the opposition to anything the government's been doing? You've just been waving this through. It is literally your job. It's your one job as leader of the opposition is to oppose the government's policies if they are bad, to be able to be there to advocate for a different set of policy prescriptions and try and maneuver within Parliament to get as much of that potentially on paper as possible. And he's just done the complete opposite and entirely not just been beholden to kind of most of what the government's saying on this with marginal differences, but of course, as we've seen, continuation of, you know, pro-American foreign policy and taking all their lines from Antony Blinken. So this idea that the prime minister, also that the opposition leader has like no power, it's not like patently ridiculous. But then again, since when has Ben Kentish ever not been that? So I don't know whether I should be holding him to such a high standard.
One of my favourite things about Keir Starmer being, you know, fucking shithoused into the position of Labour Party leader by a mainstream media consensus was that there was a kind of Orwellian inversion of language. So you had all these journalists going, this is the return of strong opposition. And what they meant was, this is a opposition that they considered respectable because it was an opposition that agreed with the government, rather than a strong opposition being defined by, I don't know, opposing the government. Let's move on to our next story. Are you sitting down? Because you better be. News has just broken that a former prime minister, who's now dead, cheated on his wife, who's now dead, with his press secretary, who's also now dead. In a piping hot exclusive from The Times, it's revealed that Harold Wilson had an affair with his deputy press secretary during his final year in office. His longest surviving press officer, Joe Haynes, decided to spill the beans at the age of 96. This is from The Times. Despite persistent and repeatedly denied rumours that Wilson had an affair with his divisive political secretary, Marsha Williams, later Baroness Falkender, he in fact privately admitted to an affair with Janet Hewlett Davies, Haynes's deputy. Haynes, 96, admits to The Times that he was told of the love match by both Wilson and Hewlett Davies, who died aged 85 in October last year, before the Prime Minister's resignation in 1976. Haynes never divulged their secret in the newspaper articles and books he subsequently wrote about British politics as a journalist and author in the ensuing decades. He is now doing so, he says, to ensure that the historical record of Wilson's governments from 1964 to 1970 and 1974 to 76 is full and accurate. The affair, according to Haynes, increased his morale in the last 2 years or so before he retired. I'm not sure I buy this argument about having to ensure the record of Wilson's time in office is full and accurate. It sounds to me a bit more like Joe Haynes, in the winter of his years, just had to get the gossip off his chest. And fair enough, I'm not a very discreet person either. But look, I'm struggling to see what's so important about Harold Wilson being a bit of a slag. Luckily, I can rely on the gang at the Today programme to let me know. This is Nick Robinson speaking.
Harold Wilson had an affair when he was Prime Minister. So what, you may ask, isn't that his business? And besides, haven't we known that for years, even though Wilson always denied it, indeed went to court to silence those that alleged it? Well, the affair everyone talked about in the 1970s, and they really did talk, and indeed in every book written about Labour's most successful ever election winner, was not simply the subject of personal gossip. It was seen as hugely politically significant, as everyone thought that Wilson had had an affair with his all-powerful political secretary, Marcia Williams, later Baroness Falkender. It was claimed that that affair had shaped the way that he had wielded power. This morning, we have news that there was, though, another affair, one kept secret for 50 years until this morning.
So everyone thought that Harold Wilson might have had an affair with someone that was actually politically significant. No one's been able to prove whether he actually did or not. But what we have been able to prove is that he did have an affair with someone else entirely, and it doesn't seem to have had an impact on how he governed. Seems like a bit of a damp squib to me. But the journos are getting a bit huffy at the suggestion that this might be anything other than Pulitzer-winning material. This is what editor-at-large at the Jewish Chronicle, Stephen Pollard, had to say. Amusing to see imbeciles dissing this story. For anyone either old enough to remember Wilson or simply interested in our country, it's a truly fascinating scoop. I find the wording of this really funny. Amusing to see imbeciles dissing this story. Yeah, man, it sounds like you find it really funny. And here was the newsagent's Lewis Goodall, also on Twitter. Endless numbers of people on here who have never landed a story in their life carping about this. It's actually an important one. One of the biggest running questions in Labour circles in the 1960s and 1970s, apparently settled for history. Yes, guys, Harold Wilson, he got around. And look, it's not that I'm uninterested in the heaving bosoms of political history. I mean, this is the stuff that award-winning period dramas are made of. What I find a bit icky is that this doesn't seem to be the earth-shattering scoop that journos are making it out to be. And without any measurable political significance, it's just pawing over the sex lives of people who are long dead. Helena, to bring this back to the land of the living, do you think that the public has a right to know whether politicians cheat in their personal lives?
I really actually have plenty of bad words to say about our political class and lots of public figures at large regardless. And one thing I will absolutely defend them on is the fact that I think it is absolutely awful. The press seem to be absolutely desperate to have every single individual detail of their private lives open to public, as if it is certainly in the public interest, quote unquote, because they pretend that it is, but lots of these things just aren't. Like, there are some edge cases, I will grant. For example, let's cast our minds back to the 1990s, when part of the kind of the conservative platform in that era was this idea of being going back to basic and back to basics with traditional family values. So stories at the time, but like Edwina Curry and Stephen Milligan, like these are things that were relevant in terms of kind of the nature of the politics that they were engaging in. But there are plenty of times where they just want to continue digging through people's personal lives for nothing other than column inches that I think is absolutely beyond the pale. And everybody, whether you're a public figure or not, should have some certain level of a right to privacy. And there should be limits on what you kind of journalists can do. To, for a more serious case of this, what I would kind of think back to is the Max Moseley story. That's something that was in no way could possibly be construed as being in the public interest. And this, they tried to ruin that man's life over it, over something that, whilst salacious, to be fair, was something that he was engaging in private in his own circumstances. And that's something that was absolutely egregious that they decided to broadcast publicly anyway. And we can see what happens to people whose lives are constantly under scrutiny, their personal lives are constantly under scrutiny from the press, in what happened to Prince Harry and Meghan Markle as a public figure, where to the point which they're giving up their royal duties because they just didn't want to have to play the game with the press. Now, as I said, there are certain circumstances where I'm happy for these to be scrutinised by politicians when it is relevant. But outside of the very specific nature of it impacting what they do in their role as a politician, in their role as somebody who sets legislation, I do not think is fair game. And a bunch of gossip over who shagged who. I mean, I would say that should be below our political class, but given the vast, but since the majority of the mainstream media is just entirely beholden to where they can rack up the most AdSense revenue and how much readership that they can get for Murdoch's rags, I really am not surprised that the people at the time seem to want to go on about stuff like this.
I think it's a question of degree, right? So I think in this case, Harold Wilson having an affair, I don't think that meets the threshold of either extremely egregious behavior or contemporary relevancy for the public to need to know about it. Indeed, I think your average MP or even frontline politician, even prime minister, having an affair is, you know, newsworthy. I don't think that it meets the public interest. But I think that if you have made a career about family values and propriety, if you're caught breaching that, then it is newsworthy. And I think if it's really egregious, extreme behavior, for instance, if you're, you know, cheating with, you know, multiple dozens of people and no one knows about each other and you're lying all the time, then you go, okay, that sort of like reached a threshold of personal conduct where maybe it is relevant for what you're like as a politician. So I wouldn't say it's never, ever relevant, but I think in this case it is just a bit of prurient interest. The last thing I'll say, though, is after all of this highfalutin business about people's right to have a personal life and right to have a private life, and that shouldn't be seen as politically significant, if I don't get hit by a bus and I know I'm going to die, on my deathbed I'll be like, guess who fucked? Like, I will be getting that gossip off of my chest, just like Joe Haynes. Thank you, Helena, for joining me tonight.
Always an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I really hope that you get to make a little deathbed confession as well. Like, just get all that gossip off your chest. Like, it needs to go, you know, back into circulation. It's the circle of life. Don't take the secrets to your grave. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You've been watching Novara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.